and wonderfully enlightened, and with a transcendent capacity to understand the mysteries of the moral universe in which he existed. But after his time, his words, and particularly his little book, The Tao Te Ching, brought around a number of scholars, and schools were built about these texts, which were so mysterious, so enigmatical, that almost any possible interpretation could be given to them. Thus, tremendous bodies of interpretive and commentary material were built up, and high intellectuals pondered these works year after year, gradually assembling themselves into a community of philosophic ascetics who departed from all worldly considerations to devote themselves almost exclusively to the efforts to transmute their own lower nature. Gradually also, as in Buddhism, the Taoistic point of view moved from the philosophic to the religious, and out of this motion arose the medievalism of Taoism, which corresponds to our age of magic, the Kabbalah, alchemy, hermetic arts, and everything of this nature. We then also meet a strange assembly of Taoist arhats, or adepts, mystics initiated into the secrets of life, possessing powers beyond ordinary mortals, living for centuries, flying about the sky on the backs of cranes. All of these strange and wonderful beings, either creatures of fantasy and imagination, or perhaps more severely and certainly, they refer to certain initiated teachers who had acquired, through Taoism, the same secret knowledge of magical arts that had once streamed from India. There is no doubt that Lao Tzu was in a position as librarian of the Chu to be in comparatively close contact with the migration of sacred writings from India, where many such works were conserved in the great libraries of the Chu dynasty. Thus, Lao Tzu actually stood as a kind of bridge between the wisdom of China and the esoteric knowledge of India. There seems to be much to imply that either Lao Tzu himself or those who came after him drank of this fountain of Indian wisdom and lore, and that out of the original Taoism they developed a form of magic, a transcendentalism, a form of tantra, around which an enormous literature was built and about which innumerable miracles are recorded, became a very fascinating subject. Also, that there was a mysterious place called the Jade Mountains, perhaps hidden away in the most remote parts of the Diamond Mountains of Korea. And here, the adepts and initiates of Taoism dwelt together in an eternal garden. And from this strange, mysterious center, they sent teachers into the world and contributed their part to the invisible government of mankind. This all becomes extremely legendary and extremely complicated. But out of all the legendary and lore, we gain some landmarks. And among these landmarks are indications that Taoism also was at one time presented as a dramatic spectacle, that dramas, theatrical productions, and other performances were given, that these various deities and genii were embodied or impersonated by priests, and that there was a secret and mysterious ritual which unfolded some of the esoteric elements of the subject. Now, with Confucianism, we do not have too much of this element. Confucianism was very largely a formal intellectualism. It was a deep and penetrating system. It was morally magnificent, ethically sublime. But Confucius himself left the Lao Tzu all the mysteries of the faith. He lived a very solemn and informed teacher with tremendous insight, tremendous integrity. But as far as we can learn, he was not involved in the establishment of secret or magical schools. He was undoubtedly himself, however, a member of the essential religious system of his time, the ancient religion of China. And it is quite possible that from birth on through life, this religion bestowed certain formulas, certain symbols, certain obligations upon the Chinese gentleman or the Chinese scholar, and that the principles of the basic faith of his nation, as communicated by Fu He, the Eternal Emperor, was communicated with the education of the classics in the great university system of China. Now, as we study these different elements and factors, we come upon one or two other interesting points, which I think are worth considering. Gradually, beginning about the 7th century, perhaps a little earlier, Buddhism, which had reached Korea, began to drift over into Japan as a result of the wonderful insight, piety, and skill of Shotoku Taishi, the Prince Regent of Japan. This far-sighted man helped to build the first monastery and to bring the faith to the Japanese people. And in the rise of Japanese Buddhism, we come upon a variety of extensions of various esoteric systems. Practically all of the Japanese schools of Buddhism directly or indirectly originated in China or Korea, and more remotely in India. And in the very beautiful old city of Nara, where the Horuji Temple is, there are murals on the walls, which unfortunately were badly damaged by fire in 1949, but have been restored. Murals of Buddhist ritual, Buddhist symbolism, that are almost identical with the paintings on the Ajanta caves of central India. Thus, we have every reason to believe that Indian influence reached to the mysterious islands of the dragonfly, as ancient Japan was called. In Japan, there were many sects, and each of these sects of Buddhism developed certain peculiar symbolisms of its own. Perhaps the most interesting from a symbolic and ritualistic standpoint of the Japanese sect is the Shingonshu, or the Shingon sect. This was founded by a most enlightened monk, mystic, Kobo Daishi. The story of Kobo Daishi is that when he was a very small child, he would kneel on the floor in prayer and Buddha would come to him and teach him. There is a very beautiful painting of the child Kobo Daishi seated upon the blossom of a lotus with his hands clasped in prayer, adoring the invisible presence of Buddha. This child grew up to become one of the great religious leaders of his time. But like several other famous persons in different parts of the world, Kobo Daishi was a universal genius. He was an architect, an artist, a musician. He helped to build cities and build temples and drain swamps. He was a master of literature and of letters and of art. He was accredited with the power of magic and of healing. And he is even said to have contributed very much to the improvement and simplification of the Japanese language. He was just one of these universal geniuses. But the most important contribution that he made was to bring over from Central Asia the great system of mandala worship, or the worship of secret magical designs and figures. The Shingonshu, therefore, is represented in Japanese art by some of the most extraordinary designs that are known in the religious world today. These designs are all symbolic representations of the universe, and may be divided essentially into two groups. Those designs which have to do with the invisible causal or divine universe, and that group which has to do with the visible universe of effects in all of its attributes. To simplify and yet clarify the mysterious relationships between the visible and the invisible, Kobo Daishi used a language of Buddhistic figures, substituting in some cases letters of the Sanskrit alphabet for the actual deities, and arranging these deities in the most interesting, amazing mathematical formulas. to inspire meditation and the advancement of man's spiritual destiny. The designs and symbols used in the production of these mandalas has not changed since they were originally devised, and all religious artists have copied them from generation to generation. They are meditation pictures, and again, are startlingly reminiscent in many aspects with the teachings of the systems of Raja and Dhyana Yoga. Kobodaishi, it is said, never died, but went to sleep in his tomb because he was bored to distraction by the vanities of the world. Regardless of that, it is believed that sometime he will come forth at the right day and restore the ancient structure of esoteric Buddhism. Who knows? Another interesting personality in the rise of Japanese Buddhism was Shonen Nichiren. Nichiren was an entirely different type of man, a rather gruff, unpleasant person, and more or less of a fanatic. But he arose at a moment when Japan was threatened by invasion by Genghis Khan and his Mongols. And it was therefore a most timely and expedient thing that the people should be brought together in some strong and simple faith. The doctrine of Nichiren is based upon one very simple thing, namely, that in any emergency, in any crisis of life, at any time of great need or prayer, a need of great sustenance or courage, the mind should simply seat itself firmly upon the realization of the scripture of the lotus, and that by merely quietly holding the words of Buddha in the mind, all doubt and uncertainty would vanish away. It was a very simple belief, and it did gain a large following, and still has a large following. Now, in Japan, in addition to the rise of various Buddhistic sects, of which possibly the most austere but the most interesting to us today is Zen, there was a nature worship, an essential religion belonging to the people, a religion founded also in strange mystic and psychic rituals and rites. This religion was Shinto. And Shinto was a worship of kamis, or spirits, or beings. Most perhaps familiar to us is that part of Shinto which deals with the worship of the emperor, or deified heroes. In any event, however, Shinto has given Japan one of its great and important gifts, and that has been its love of nature, its tremendous adoration for the consciousness everywhere present in natural things. In Nara also, the city we previously mentioned, is the great Kasura Palace, one of the most beautiful examples of architecture in the world. And this was essentially a Shinto monument. It has been visited by millions of people all over the world who have found in its gardens and buildings an exquisite design that in itself inspires the loftiest and most sublime religious feelings. And this is regardless of the religion to which you may belong. It is simply the religion of beauty, the religion of graciousness and simplicity, as part of the great essential doctrine of Shinto. The Shinto faith has its own sacred books, which are combinations of cosmological and historical accounts. The principal ones of these are called the Kojiki and the Nihonji. These books deal with the prehistoric foundation of Japan, the myths and legends relating to the gods, the establishment of the royal dynasty, and its descent from Amaterasu Omikami, goddess of the sun, and all of the various legends and incidents which make up the first several centuries of Japanese history. These books are held to be sacred, because in Shinto, history is sacred. And Shinto justifies this on the simple ground that history is sacred because history teaches. History teaches us as scripture teaches us. For there can be no scripture more valid than history, which shows clearly and beyond doubt how all action results in natural and appropriate reaction, how evil destroys itself, how corruption overflows and destroys its own power, how dictators rise and fall. And most of all in history, we find the inevitable emergence of the ordinary person as the one most loved and honored by the gods. The esotericism of Shinto consists of meetings and assemblies held not only for dramatic purposes, for the preservation and perpetuation of the No theater and the other high forms of Nara and Kamakura artistry, but in Shintoism we have a strong survival of spiritism. In Shintoism we have oriental spiritualism. We have mediumship, the tilting of tables, the materializing of objects, teleportation from one place to another. We have the development of secret arts and sciences concerning the control of the body. And out of the combination of Shinto and Buddhism, we have such doctrines as those of Judo, in which in the lower grades we have discipline and body control, and in the higher grades a deep and profound esoteric knowledge of the nerve centers of the human body and how these can be manipulated to destroy life or to restore it after the individual is dead. All these points have a little something to do with Shinto. Shinto, represented to our mind largely by the red torii gate or the beautiful inverted fan-shaped cone of Fujiyama, is in reality a ritual of kinship with life. It is the ritual of the cherry tree viewing. It is the ritual of the night of the full moon, when the whole community goes out simply to gaze upon beauty. It is the ritual of the 17-syllable poem. It is the ritual of the unpainted walls, the mysterious festivals of the dead, when it is believed that the country of these people is so beautiful that once a year even the dead wish to leave paradise and return to the gardens of the Kasura. This type of thinking is Shinto. And we cannot say that it is not a valid religion. We cannot say that while it worships nature in numerous personified and non-personified attributes, that it has not discovered the spirituality of the bird, the spirituality of the laws governing the life and death of the butterfly, a spirituality which comes forth in the most simple reverence for the common things of life, and yet at the same time, influenced by Zen, becomes a complete self-discipline in which the individual becomes almost impregnable simply because he has lost all trace of fear. These various phases of our subject, I think, are worth some consideration. Now, across the entire surface of the areas which we have been considering, China, even India to a lesser degree, because by this time India was pretty well out of the old religious picture, but wherever Buddhism certainly extended its sphere of influence, secret societies began to develop their third aspect, and that was political. And in the rise of the political societies in Asia, we do not have a clean and complete break away from the older doctrines. We have the rise of a new type of interpretation. Perhaps no phase of this is more interesting than the Hung Society of China, or the Heaven and Earth Federation. Here we find flowing into a definite secret society, with rites, degrees, passwords, grips, symbols, with the ornamentations, jewels, and adornments of the lodge, with all the means of recognition, all of the rites of preparation and purification, all of the most severe and strict obligations of conduct and character, and a lodge room properly decorated and symbolically populated with officers and various personalities representing both physical and spiritual realities. Here in the assembly of heaven and earth, of the Hung Association, we have a secret society in Asia which is based upon a mingling of Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Joss, which is the Chinese equivalent of Shinto. All of which makes a rather complicated picture. But then these secret societies were always a little complicated, and that is one of the reasons why the initiates never tired of trying to explore the subject a little further. In the Heaven and Earth Association, or the Hung Society, we had also the culmination of 500 years of Chinese political unrest. We had one dynasty of corrupt rulers after another. We had gradual decline of the rights of the people. We had, therefore, a situation in which Buddhist leaders, Confucianists, and Taoists especially, forgot whatever differences there may have been among them and united for the simple purpose of preserving China. Now, they had an idea behind this, which is a little different, perhaps, from our viewpoint, because when we unite to preserve something, we immediately start waving a banner, and first thing you know, we have a John Birch Society or something in our midst. The Chinese did it differently. The Chinese took the attitude that the beginning of the liberation of China was the education of the individual in those values which were essential to his own proper living and to the preservation of society. So the Heaven and Earth Association sought to educate the ignorant millions of China. It had to be a secret society, or it would have been exterminated by those who wanted no one but themselves to be educated. And China had not forgotten that one of their emperors, who was unable to attain much scholarship himself, condemned all of the learned intellectuals, the artists, the musicians, the sculptors, the philosophers, astronomers, and priests of China to go out into the desert and build a wall for him. And thus it was that the Great Wall of China came into being. So the Chinese did not dare to expose their hands. And the question then arose, which has frequently arisen in secret societies, how to educate an individual painlessly, quickly, and adequately. We have never really solved this one ourselves, but it is a good thought. Instead, therefore, of settling down to the present system of curriculum, which may or may not be effective in about 18 years, the Chinese had to work out a system whereby certain essential ideas could be quickly and adequately communicated. And they did this in ritualism. They did it by presenting the candidate with certain spectacles, attended by solemnity. They caused him to be deeply mindful of what he was experiencing. He regarded himself as peculiarly privileged in that he could be present, and that therefore he had a great obligation. For having attained this knowledge, he must use it, and he must also protect it at all costs from the profane. Thus, in a comparatively short time, a great ethical, moral instruction was transferred. The individual did not necessarily become skilled in arts and sciences, but he did become skilled in the concept of right and wrong, which we have more or less completely lost sight of. He was skilled in dedication, devotion, and honor. He was skilled in fraternity, in willingness to defend and support those things which he held to be right, even at the expense of his own life. He was taught to obey. He learned to discipline his own faculties and powers. And he received a strange inner vision of what the gods wanted of man, which to these people was the greatest of all instructions. To know what the universe wants, to know how to be a faithful custodian of universal knowledge, how to apply principles to those ends which are of the common utility to all. These are the truths which education must essentially communicate. So in the Association of Heaven and Earth, the candidate was told the meaning of the various myths and legends which in popular living he had general acceptance. Almost all the characters of Buddhism which with which we are familiar, the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin, the Gracious Lady of Compassion, the Bodhisattva Manjushri, the Lord of Wisdom, the Bodhisattva Seishi, the God of Strength and Truth, and dear old Hopai, the rotund Bodhisattva, who is a symbolic representation of Maitreya, the Buddha to be. All of these appear in the rituals of the Hung Association. Parts, masks, and all, they come to communicate something of their doctrine, to bind the candidate to the old and the true, to remind him of the mysterious truth locked in mythology. And I think it is quite possible that the same was true in China, that was true in Greece, and that many of the popular legends now circulated in China were originally part of the ritual of the Hung Association. In any event, this association did struggle on, did make its place politically, did accomplish the first liberation of China, and did establish the democracy of the Chinese people under its own appointed initiate leader, Dr. Sun Yat-sen. The Hung Association was therefore evidence of a long descent, a descent of ideas, and the continuance and preservation of a priceless heritage of conviction, which is tremendously important to the average person, tremendously important to all of us, to have a little of that sentimentality about us that we like to believe, we like to hope that the great truths that we have held sacred are real, are important, and can result in a universal advantage for mankind. In Japan, we also find the rise of political society. Japan had a very rocky historical background. And after the disappearance of the gods and those great princes descended from Jimmu Tamu, the first emperor of Japan, there were troubles, one trouble after another. These troubles resulted in centuries of civil wars, resulted in misery and pain to thousands of people. And little by little, the dynasties and powers of the people were exploited. The emperor was practically a religious exile, with no temporal authority whatever. And one powerful family after another, at one time the Fujiwara family, and at another time the great Minamotos, ruled tyrannically as military dictators, forming what was called the curtain government. These leaders paid hollow homage to the emperor, but actually ran the country in their own way. After a while, however, there arose among the Japanese people one rather strong, not particularly desirable, and certainly utterly despotic person, but still a born natural leader, and that was Hideyoshi. Hideyoshi was to a certain degree the Oliver Cromwell of Japan. Others have likened him to Napoleon, but I think the Cromwell parallel is perhaps the most apt. He became, so to say, Lord Protector. He was not officially a shogun or ruler because he came from a comparatively humble family and was not accepted socially. On the other hand, no one could refuse him on any other level than the social standing. On one occasion, he wished to have an interview with the emperor, but because of his low social status, was not permitted to enter the imperial presence. With the kind of foresight that made him one of the most powerful men of his country, he simply leaned over and, seeing the son of the emperor standing nearby, picked up the child in his arms and walked past the guards and into the imperial presence. No one dared to touch him because he was carrying the emperor's son. This was his way of doing things, and he got things done. But his son was not much of a help any more than the son of Oliver Cromwell was a particular success. And another family, the great family of the Tokugawa, came into power. And the Tokugawa, under the leadership of its first great founding member, Ieyasu, became the ruling power in Japan for nearly 250 years. In this time, peace was restored. The condition of the people constantly improved. The merchant took the place of the aristocrat. The samurai went entirely out of fashion and became hopelessly in debt to the ordinary shopkeepers. Gradually, a powerful, protected democracy arose. The Tokugawa shoguns were one at one moment strict and the next lax. They made many laws that nobody could keep, and then they insisted on the keeping of a number of laws that they had never made. But at the same time, all in all, things went along rather well until the first impact of Western culture upon the Japanese people. At this time, trouble started to brew when it became obvious that the great hierarchy of the Tokugawa was coming to an end. Then, at this moment, we had another rise of secret societies, this time in Japan. Now, they may have come along earlier because back many, many centuries before, the great Japanese hero, Yoshitsune Kuni, was said to have been educated in a forest by a group of strange bird men called Tengu. Under the rulership of a strange and mysterious person, the Dai Tengu, this hero and prince became the most fearless and skilled of warriors. Now, no one has ever been able to quite decide who the Tengu was, who the Tengu were. I suspect very strongly that they were a little like the Robin Hood's forces in Sherwood Forest. I suspect that the Tengu were an anti-social political group. They were supposed to have had large noses, and this causes some people to think that they might have been the remnants of Europeans who had, for some reason or another, gotten into Japan and couldn't get out. This was a little supported also by the fact that the Dai Tengu was represented with red hair. This was not possible to a Japanese, so perhaps it had something to do with foreign background. But in any way, the legend gradually spread that in the forests and mountains and hidden places of Japan, there were mysterious beings who were ever ready to help the oppressed, to whom those in trouble could turn for assistance, for relief, even for food. That all you had to do really was to proclaim yourself the son of liberty and go out in the forest, and the Tengu is bound to find you. Now, this suggests something, and it doesn't necessarily suggest anything metaphysical. It suggests more definitely and practically that there was a gradual building up of an order of people, an order of men, dedicated to the overthrow of the Tokugawa shogunate. Now, if this is doubted, let us remember what happened in Mexico at the time of Miguel Hidalgo. Mexico at that time, of course, was not permitted to have secret societies. But in the place of what we would call secret societies today, the Mexicans developed what were called reading circles. These reading circles were composed, presumably, of poets who sat down together and read their poetry. A most innocuous pursuit. Although probably in good Spanish it was very charming. But it is quite difficult to imagine some of the fiery characters which were associated with the Mexican labors of liberation as being particularly addicted to verse or to versification. But we do know that the so-called reading societies were the only way in which freedom-loving persons could find an excuse for assembly without danger of persecution. It became more or less like the alchemist. If anyone was foolish enough to spend his evening with poetry or making gold, you might as well let him do it. So in this way, the difficulties were avoided. Now in Japan, at about the time in which the legends of the Tengu were getting good, solid ground, there arose in Tokyo, which was the actual seat of the Tokugawa shogunate, a large group of reading circles. Now these reading circles also consisted of poets. These poets, however, were perhaps a little briefer than the Mexican ones, because they seldom did a poem over 3 lines or 17 syllables, which meant they could do a number of poems successfully in one evening. But these reading circles found also that they had further trouble, and that the only way in which they could function at all was to hide themselves away in the least suspected and possible quarter. So they retired into what would be the European equivalent of Montmartre, or the art district and colony of Tokyo, an area without morals or without supervision. And here they very quietly plotted the fall of the Tokugawa shogunate. And in their little prints and paintings and pictures and so forth, they hid symbolically the whole story of their intent. They also worked out a very beautiful language of flower arrangement in which they could communicate with each other entirely by floral designs. They devised many different tricks and subterfuges, even weaving some of their important projects into brocades, and after having woven into this brocade some sentiments such as "down with the shogunate," they then proceeded to sell the shogun the brocade, and he very happily and gloriously wore it. This was a true example of the spirit of the time. But out of it all, things happened. And all of a sudden, with a crash, the 2.5-century control of Japan by the military dictatorship fell apart. Practically every force upon which the military depended for protection turned against them. They found that their ranks had been riddled with some kind of treason, and they were never able to find out what it was. But actually, the Japanese people were wiser than the secluded shoguns, who liked to sit back somewhere in their palaces and play Go or something of that nature. They were not realists. The merchants of Nagasaki and Osaka were realists. They saw the Western world opening. They saw that it was inevitable that Japan would have to finally become one of the great family of nations. And when the government failed to make the necessary adjustment, these secret societies moved in their political function, very much as the Hung Society moved in China. Yet the Japanese political societies also had religious backgrounds. They used the same symbolism, the same legends, the same stories. And many of the legends which we find in the tales of the Genji, or in the wonderful stories attributed to the Lady Murasaki, these legends come back in the rituals of these secret societies. And there is no doubt in the world that by double talk, they managed to protect themselves against the animosities and persecutions of their time. The final end of the Japanese secret societies was the reestablishment of the empire in the person of the great Emperor Meiji. And it is from the restoration of the monarchy and the end of the Tokugawa shogunate that the advancement of Japan in world affairs is to be measured. There is no doubt that in terms of his own people, the Emperor Meiji was one of the greatest benefactors in the history of Japan. He was largely restored to office by the activity of these societies working under the surface of Japanese life. So we have here a few examples of the points that we wish to make, namely that there is this common pattern of procedure to be found in practically all of the nations of Asia. we find that even in small countries where large movements were not practical, there arose heroes like King Mongut of Siam, who became the spearheads of progress and who used the knowledge which they possessed for the advancement of their people. This brings us to one point which I think is very interesting as we study Oriental religion. I think this point we should all remember. As far as in some instances we like to think or believe in our own way that religion has been opposed to science, has been opposed to progress, I think we should realize that in Asia this was not consistently the case. Practically all religion was for progress. Religion was for the advancement of man and not for the repression of man. And from the time of the collapse of the older and corrupted Brahmanic rites, which had fallen into disrepute, from that time on, religion in Asia was almost without exception devoted to the advancement of knowledge. Buddhism, Shintoism, Taoism, and Confucianism all respected progress. There was no talk whatever of a religion coming in conflict with science. There was no consideration of a materialism at the expense of religion. In India, there were materialistic sects, and there have been in most other Asiatic countries. But these sects were never particularly meaningful, and no one even bothered to persecute them. For the most part, the entire history of Eastern religion was, perhaps from its ancient Aryan roots, that the more we know, the more we grow, the more we unfold the esoteric and mystical parts of our own natures, the better people we are religiously speaking. That God wants man to know, because it is only the person who knows who can legitimately and honorably cooperate. It is only the person who knows that can glorify God. There is no glorification for God or man in the rulership of an ignorant world. Therefore, as a prince is only honored if his people are enlightened, so a universe only honors God by becoming enlightened, becoming aware of the divine plan and the divine purpose through the advancement of every form of knowledge and insight available to the human being. So everywhere in the East, we find religion, either publicly or privately, either through its physical and visible manifestation or through its esoteric and secret teaching, everywhere we find it encouraging the human being to know, rewarding science, rewarding art, rewarding philosophy, and actually rewarding the non-believer if he was still a person making a valid contribution. For whereas we divide religion in the West very largely from our daily life as far as the common practices are concerned, in the Orient there has never been such a division. Religion moves into life as the garden moves into the house. Religion is just as much a part of our daily experience as any secular subject. There is no division. And because this is true, the people live more or less in a constant atmosphere of religious acceptances. And because of these acceptances, we find they have the capacity for a quiet, disciplined existence, an existence in which beauty, harmony, and truth are constantly available forces and factors. We certainly hope that we have some concern, but we certainly hope that the westernizing of Asia will not destroy too much of this ancient pattern, because someday this pattern must either be world-cultivated or we shall all be in difficulty. Some think today that this pattern, which was Asia for the last 5,000 years, is going to move into the West, that the West will become the custodian of Asiatic introversion, and while the East or Asia becomes constantly more westernized, that we will find the increasing need for the strengthening of our internal life. Whether it be in the Far East, as in India, China, Japan, or in the Near East, as in Persia, Arabia, Syria, the religious mysteries have always had to do with this enrichment and evolution of man's internal life. What would you say then, you might ask, is the condition of these esoteric orders at this time in Asia? Do they still exist? I think there's absolutely no doubt whatever that the old esoteric orders do exist. I think some of them are corrupt. I think some of them are now perhaps legitimately represented by only a handful of persons who have become deeply inspired and deeply aware of the truth involved. I think some of the older faiths ceased and have been partly restored by later students, so that there are breaks in the line of descent. I think the Buddhist mysteries are still practiced, particularly in the less accessible areas. But there is a strong esoteric doctrine in Japan under Qigong, and a very deep philosophical mysticism under Zen. I think what we call psychic manifestation, and to a large part, the ancient spiritistic rites of primitive people, including our own American Indians, are still practiced by Shinto. There is no doubt that in Islam, the hierarchy of the Sufis, the Dervishes, the Druzes, and other esoteric groups, the such hierarchy is still functioning strongly and consistently. There is probably a stronger esoteric hierarchy structure under Islam than under any other faith in the world today. In India, the mystical sects, which stemmed from Hinduism, are still strong. Hinduism itself is at this time an uncertain quantity. There seems much to indicate that, like most of the ancient religions of the West, its essential secrets have more or less perished, or perhaps more correctly, have been absorbed into their own descendants, that is, into the 10 systems of philosophy that stemmed from Hinduism at a very ancient time. I think there's no doubt at all that the best part of Hinduism did survive in Yoga, Vedanta, Buddhism, and in the sect of the Jains. That China still has secret societies functioning, we know. That secret societies are beginning to take a considerable part in Korean existence, particularly on the boundary areas between North and South Korea, we also know. We know that China is again rehabilitating the Hung society to get rid of its present overlord. There is much evidence in the Indo-Chinese area that Buddhism is making valiant efforts to integrate its own position by trying to bring greater insight to the people of that particular area. Mysticism, asceticism, and subjects of this nature are still valid in Asia. But the average tourist can go for a long time without coming in contact with any of them. The Indian guru system still functions. But more and more it is retiring into a very recondite, contemplative kind of existence. It no longer wishes to advertise itself. And the gurus, who are the links between modern Hindus and the ancient structure of their faith, are less and less inclined to discuss, shall we say, esoteric hierarchy. They are much more inclined to take the attitude that the disciple must develop his own esoteric resources. On the other hand, there is much to suggest that the concept of the Jagat Guru or the Brahmatma still exists in India, that there are recognized to be teachers, adept Mahatmas in distant and remote areas, but the Hindu declines to tell where these are. And he may also, with a somewhat sly expression, remind us that there is nothing more remote from us than our next-door neighbor whom we do not understand. Therefore, that it would not be necessary for any Mahatma to remain in the forests of the Himalayas in order to remain unrecognized. He could be perfectly unrecognized and be our next-door neighbor. because the qualities which he possesses could only be known or recognized by another who was attentive to the ancient signs and landmarks and was able to recognize a degree of spirituality beyond that of an ordinary person. So I have talked to Hindus who know quite a bit about these problems, and they all affirm that the old hierarchies do exist, but that they have retired from common knowledge, and that those desiring to make some form of contact with them cannot do so by taking the next plane to Bombay, but would have to remain up there at this time, quietly in the discipline of their order, under the assumption that when the disciple attains certain insight himself, he will not only be directed where to go and when to go, but as one old Indian teacher who had disciples all over the world told me, he said, when the disciple is ready, he doesn't have to go anywhere, for the very simple reason that through inner contact, he can be where he needs to be, and he can live in any part of the world and have continual relationships with his guru if he is ready. So it is largely no longer a matter of geography. It is a matter now of man searching for esoteric value. And the whole trend of esotericism in the last several hundred years has been to put the responsibility for growth right back on the individual. That he must grow by his own efforts, by his own integrity, by his own dedication. Not because he is prodded along by some doctrine or some teacher, but because in his own heart of hearts, in the soul of his own soul, he knows that this growth is what he must have. And he knows that the advancement of his own spiritual state is what deity demands of him. And that therefore it is his duty and his privilege to grow, thus revealing through his own character the latent mystical powers and attributes which we associate with the initiates of the ancient mysteries. Well, time's up, so I guess we'll have to let you all go home before the bus leaves.